Section 21, Ambedkar and going for refuge. From 1981 to 1986, I spent the autumn of each year in Tuscany, taking part in the annual men's preordination retreat. In the middle of the 1985 retreat, during the 8 days devoted to the private ordinations, I found the thought of Dr. Ambedkar constantly impressing itself on my mind in a very powerful fashion and refusing, as it were, to go away. What could be the reason for this, I wondered. Eventually I realized that those were the very days when the ex-untouchable Indian Buddhists would be commemorating the original mass conversion, which had taken place on October the 14th, 1956. This realization brought to a head a number of things about which I had been thinking for some time. In particular, I felt I really did want to write the booklet on Ambedkar and Buddhism to which I had been giving thought on and off for 2 or 3 years. I could now see how it should be done, and towards the end of the month, actually wrote to Lokamitra giving details of the 9 chapters into which it would be divided. Though I'd hoped to start work on the booklet soon after my return to Padmaloka, in the event I was not able to do so before mid-February, and it was not until early September that this latest project of my pen was ready for the press, having grown in the course of writing from a booklet into a small book. Ambedkar and Buddhism was published on December the 12th, 1986, 6 days after the 30th anniversary of Ambedkar's death, and launched at a public meeting in London at which tribute was paid to the memory of the great untouchable leader. In the book, I drew attention to the real significance of Ambedkar and the nature of his achievement, looked at the diabolical system from which he had sought to deliver the untouchables, and traced the successive steps of the road by which he and his followers travelled from Hinduism to Buddhism. I also studied the way in which Ambedkar discovered his spiritual roots, explored his thoughts on the subject of the Buddha and the future of his religion, surveyed the historic occasion on which he and 380,000 untouchables were spiritually reborn, studied his posthumously published magnum opus, and saw what happened after his death. In addition, I gave my personal recollections of Ambedkar. Though the subject of conversion to Buddhism cropped up in most chapters of the book, and though conversion to Buddhism meant going for refuge with the Three Jewels, only in one chapter did going for refuge feature at all prominently. This was, of course, Chapter 7, the Great Mass Conversion, which in a way constituted the central chapter of the whole book. In this chapter, I not only described the colourful and moving ceremony at which first Ambedkar and his wife and then his followers went for refuge to the Buddha Dharma Sangha, but also attempted to explain the implications of certain aspects of that ceremony. Ambedkar and his wife took the 3 refuges and 5 precepts from U Chandramani, the oldest and senior-most monk in India, repeating the Pali formulae after him thrice in the usual manner. Having taken the 3 refuges and 5 precepts from U Chandramani, however, Ambedkar proceeded to administer them to his followers himself. This constituted a definite break with tradition, or with what had come to be regarded as tradition. In Theravada, in Southeast Asia, at least, where pseudo-monastic triumphalism was rife, and where monks invariably took the lead on ceremonial occasions, it was unthinkable that a mere layman should presume to administer the refuges and precepts in the presence of his socio-religious superiors. Such a proceeding would have been considered as showing gross disrespect, not only to those monks who were actually present, but to the whole monastic order, and would not have been tolerated for an instant. Ambedkar's action in administering the refuges and precepts to his followers himself, instead of allowing U Chandramani to administer them, therefore represented a bold and dramatic departure from existing Theravadin praxis, and, indirectly, a return to something more in accordance with the spirit of the Buddha's teaching. Indeed, it represented even more than that, for, as I also explained, by thus demonstrating that an upasaka, no less than a bhikshu, could administer the refuges and precepts. And Petaka was reminding both the old Buddhists and the new that the difference between those who lived as bhikshus and those who lived as upasakas and upasikas was only a difference, not a division, since all alike went for refuge with the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. Thus he was, in effect, asserting the fundamental unity of the whole Buddhist spiritual community, male and female, monastic and lay. End of quote. That same unity was also asserted in Ambedkar's other break with tradition. Having converted his followers to Buddhism, he was determined to make sure that they would remain Buddhists and not revert to their old ways and be reabsorbed into Hinduism, as had happened once before in Indian history. After repeating them himself, therefore, he also administered to his followers a series of 22 vows, which were drawn up specially for the occasion. These vows spelled out the implications of being a Buddhist, as distinct from a Hindu, in some detail. Indeed, in making the vows an integral part of the conversion ceremony, Ambedkar made it clear that a lay Buddhist was a full member of the Buddhist spiritual community, thereby asserting the fundamental unity of that community, and that the lay Buddhist, no less than the monk, was expected actually to practice Buddhism. His followers could hardly be expected to practice Buddhism, however, unless they felt that they were full members of the Buddhist spiritual community, and therefore real Buddhists. This meant that they had to be formally received into that community, just as the monk was formally received into the monastic order, and undertake to live as lay followers of the Buddha with the same seriousness as the monk undertook to live as a monk follower. They had, in other words, to take the refuges and precepts plus the 22 vows. As I worked on my description of that historic ceremony and tried to bring out the significance of some of the things Ambedkar had done, I became more than ever aware how much there was in common between his approach to Buddhism and mine. Though the saying itself may not have been current in his day, for him too, commitment was primary, lifestyle secondary, as his contemptuous dismissal of pseudo-monasticism in The Buddha and the Future of His Religion abundantly testified. His assertion, in effect, of the fundamental unity of the Buddhist spiritual community corresponded to my own insistence on the central importance of going for refuge. For did not that unity consist in the fact that all members of the Buddhist spiritual community went for refuge with the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and had not Ambedkar shown that in respect of giving, no less than in respect of taking, those refugees, monks and laymen, were on an equal footing? Moreover, in the course of a press conference held on the eve of his conversion, Ambedkar made it clear, in response to a question as to which form of Buddhism he would be adopting when he embraced Buddhism, that his Buddhism, quote, would adhere to the tenets of the faith as taught by the Buddha himself, without involving his people in differences which had arisen on account of Hinayana and Mahayana. End of quote. This corresponded to my own ecumenical attitude, as well as to the fact that in the Western Buddhist order, or Trilokya Bodhama Sangha, we consider ourselves to be simply Buddhists, in the sense of individuals who have gone and continue to go for refuge to the three jewels, and who look for guidance and inspiration to the scriptures and teachings of all the different schools of Buddhism. Thus, it was not surprising that on the completion of my chapter on the great mass conversion, and indeed on the completion of Ambedkar and Buddhism itself, I should have been more than ever convinced that my approach to Buddhism was in line with that of the great untouchable leader, and that the new Buddhist movement with which so many of Ambedkar's followers were now in contact was a direct continuation of his own work for the Dhamma.